Welcome to the first podcast in our new Think Ahead series, which offers evidence-based discussions and insights to help you navigate big business issues. I'm Julian Birkinshaw, Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship and Vice Dean at London Business School. Today's topic is breakthrough growth and how to achieve it. I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague at LBS, Helen Edwards, Adjunct Associate Professor of Marketing.
Hello, it's good to be here.
So Helen, to kick this off, we talk about breakthrough growth. But what do we mean by that term, breakthrough growth?
It's such a loaded word, isn't it? We sort of bandy it around all the time. And I think when I see people use it in business, they tend to sort of slightly freeze. But I think what we're talking about is beyond those incremental percentage point share gains into something much bigger and more sustained that brings new people to a category, maybe even reshapes that category or serves consumers in new ways in a category, in ways that we might not have thought of. And often it is driven by consumers themselves. So if you think about veganism, that led to breakthrough growth for many different types of businesses and organizations, but it was driven by consumers. But I guess that's, I'm in marketing, that's what you'd expect me to say. What about from your perspective, from inside the organization?
So from my point of view, and I'm a professor of strategy, but that also includes all the organizational aspects and the things that often get in the way. We have huge inertia in our organizations. We're really good at doing the stuff we've always done. And so breakthrough growth, in a similar fashion to what you say, does get people a bit nervous because it means that you've got to really take a few risks to create new products, new offerings, new business models that are untried and unproven. And so organizationally, often what that looks like is some senior person either taking sort of a big bet themselves on throwing some money at a new idea, or sometimes carving out a separate unit who's been charged with the job of doing that. That's sometimes called new venture divisions or venturing units or incubators or whatever. I mean, there's lots of challenges with doing that. But the point is you've got to find a way organizationally of giving yourself the space to then have at least a half a chance of doing what you're talking about, which is tapping into some unmet need or some user group that hasn't been seen before. Do you have any other examples? I'm fascinated. I mean, veganism is a great example, but you know, companies, established companies that have created breakthrough growth.
Well, the one that will blow your mind is Nike, probably, because exercise for its own sake simply wasn't done in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, there's somebody was arrested for jogging in the late 60s. And Nike was the company that sort of started the exercise revolution. They were in it right at the beginning. And Phil Knight often talks about how he didn't create the exercise revolution, but he rode it. And I think that's what I'm driving at, is that if you look at consumers, if you look at people and how they want to live their lives, they are creating new movements for businesses to help more people live their lives in a certain way. And I guess I wonder why businesses don't look out more. I think it's because we've got used to looking at a technological disruption, wouldn't you say?
No, that's exactly what I was going for next, which is, I think the right way to think about it is always, what is that unmet need, that opportunity in the market? The other side of the story is the technological developments that make certain things possible that weren't possible before. And of course, a lot of this is, you know, digital technology, but biotechnology and renewable energy. I mean, these are technological developments that suddenly allow us to do things that we couldn't do before, which can also then be the platform on which breakthrough growth is achieved. So, you know, some combination of unmet market need and technological development, that for me is the kind of the sweet spot.
Absolutely. I think you're looking for that collision, aren't you, between where consumers are moving in a direction to where technology or some sort of breakthrough can meet them and serve them better. And I think that the whole area of measuring our daily biometrics, in my world we call that the quantified self, is an area exactly like that. You know, health systems are struggling. People want to understand more about their health. Technology can have the answer, and you have this collision of factors that create almost a perfect sweet spot, as you say.
Right. And occasionally, rather more pedestrian things are possible through technology. I mean, if you think about the huge success of the Ubers and the Airbnbs, I mean, they didn't reinvent taxis or hotel rooms or renting rooms, but they just made the market work that much more effectively, that there was actually a breakthrough growth opportunity there without even inventing the category again.
And what's your view on who needs to get there first? Do you think it's entrepreneurs get there first always, or do you think established companies can get them first or shouldn't get there first?
So my view for large established firms is what our colleague Costas Marquides called fast second. In other words, as a big company, you might think you want to be the one getting there first, but in fact, there's lots of startups out there trying things out. Most of them will fail. And you've got such deep pockets and expertise and scope and brand recognition that you should really be setting your sights as an established company on seeing where the market is going through the efforts of the entrepreneurs and then, you know, tackling those opportunities quickly by mobilizing your resources when you see the opportunity opening up. For me, that's the biggest. Should growth actually always be the goal? I mean, it's almost axiomatic in a business school to talk about growth, but we should at least scrutinize that assertion.
I think that's right. I mean, I did a lot of research with people, just normal people, as part of the book that I've just written. And one thing that was really striking was people wanting to consume better. It's not that they want to not consume. They do. There's a kind of joy to it, and we need to. But they want to consume better. And sometimes they also want to consume less. So I think that then lays a responsibility at organisations and businesses' worlds, you know, to deliver against that. You know, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, relentless growth at any cost?
Yeah. I mean, it can't and it shouldn't. In other words, if every company relentlessly pursued growth for its own sake, I think we would end up in a bad place. And I can think of many industries, energy, for example. I mean, you know, British Petroleum, BP, is now explicit that it is going for, you know, value ahead of growth. I mean, you know, there's only so much BP can do in terms of growing, but they can absolutely point their ship in the direction of sustainability and renewable fuel and doing more with the resources that they've got. So it's just one of dozens of examples of companies which have realised that growth should not be the only objective. And I think, you know, there's lots of things going on there, but, you know, a big chunk of it is that if the global economy is only actually growing at 2 or 3 or 4% a year, you know, it's completely ridiculous to think that companies should be trying to go much faster than that, because there's just not room in on the planet for all of that. And that's even before you get to, you know, the use of, you know, the planet's resources and things like that.
Absolutely. And I think consumers, people, are looking for consumption that serves the planet and people better. So,
indeed,
again, it matches that ambition.
Agreed. Helen, another question that arises from this discussion is, what are the pitfalls of growth? In other words, if a company is pursuing breakthrough growth and gets it wrong, what's the downside?
I think from a consumer perspective, again, rushing at something and getting it wrong is almost worse than doing it slowly and perhaps being following somebody else, because consumers are very unforgiving when a business tries something and gets it wrong. And a really good example of that coming out of marginal behaviours is Wicca. Modern day witchcraft is very popular among younger audiences. And Sephora, the beauty company, rushed out a junior witch kit. And they got berated for it by people who love Wicca and mainstream consumers who just said, you're just jumping on a bandwagon. And I think that's the danger from a consumer point of view. And from a business perspective, I guess it's about wasting resources, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of many companies who have thrown their weight behind big new campaigns. You know, the famous New Coke example is one that everybody remembers. And, you know, spectacular waste of resources and, of course, a loss of brand recognition. So, albeit temporarily. And so, yeah, and when I'm advising companies, I do persuade them, I do encourage them rather, to try to take a sort of staged approach, right? In other words, look, are there ways of taking this big idea and doing it in a progressive way, in a limited market or in a limited rollout that allows you to test this hypothesis before you scale it up? Because, yeah, it's just common business sense that most business ideas can actually be de-risked we can use what's often called lean startup thinking by creating some sort of minimum viable product. Because if you don't do that, the risk of falling flat on your face and you know, taking years to pick up the pieces is quite real. So we recently held a discussion about these issues and more at London Business School. The panel featured myself and Helen and our London Business School colleague, Linda Yu, adjunct professor of economics at London Business School. And we were joined by Chris McCarthy of Johnson & Johnson MedTech. The discussion was moderated by James Hurley, assistant business editor of The Times. You can listen to it now.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Julian, and good morning, everyone. It's lovely to see you all here. And to breakthrough growth and how to achieve it, we were just saying when we were talking a moment ago, that is a very difficult thing to achieve. If it was easy to achieve, I guess we'd still have Liz Truss as Prime Minister, wouldn't we? But we hope to shed a little bit of light on this subject and perhaps what some of the challenges are as well and why it's so difficult for companies to achieve is something that's interesting to explore too. Before we dive into this, I'm going to ask all of the panel to introduce themselves and maybe just set the scene very briefly as well about, I guess, what are they're most interested in talking to us about this morning with regards to this topic. So Linda, why don't we start with you?
Thanks very much. Lovely to be here. And can I just echo Julian James's welcome to all of you. It's nice to see everybody IRL. In real life, I've learned some lingo during the pandemic. So my interest as an economist is really in two areas. So one, I've written two economic history books to learn examples from history of how it is that companies and countries achieve breakout growth. So my latest book actually came out a few days ago, The Great Crashes. You know, where there's a bust, there's a boom. And the ones that do well coming out of, if you do well when there's a downturn, you do really well where there's an upturn. So that's one area that I've been fascinated by in terms of learning from history. And the second area is that I sit on a number of FTSE 100 boards, and I also chair an investment company that only invests in private growth companies. So I've seen my share of failures and remarkable successes. So it'd be absolutely wonderful to have a chat about some of that.
Chris.
Great. Good morning, everyone. My name is Chris McCarthy. I work at Johnson & Johnson. I've actually been in medtech for 19 years. I'm currently lead of strategy and chief of staff for the EMEA medtech business. And today, just importantly, I'm here in a personal capacity to share my perspective from industry. And it's not the view of J&J, but I start with a question when we talk about breakthrough growth by first being clear on actually what do we mean? And certainly in healthcare and in medtech, growth is all about treating more patients. It's about improving outcomes whilst reducing the cost to serve. That's what we refer to as being the triple aim, and that's ultimately our North Star. And when you think about the world around us, today still 5 billion people don't have access to healthcare. That's over 60% of the global population. And even in developed markets such as the UK, over 7 million patients are waiting on waiting lists for surgery in the UK. That's one in 10. So the unmet need is clear. There's huge opportunity, even as a market leader, really to change the trajectory of healthcare globally. And in order to overcome a challenge as big as that, clearly I don't believe one player or party can achieve that on their own. It does require the activation of the full ecosystem. And when I talk about ecosystem, I mean payers, providers, policymakers, industry, to name only a few, all coming together. And maybe what I can talk to over the time this morning is what we at J&J have focused on to drive our part in touching more patients, improving outcomes and improving society. Today we touch 80 million patients, and we went through a full potential exercise to actually look at growth opportunities to reach more patients. And in fact, ask the question, what would need to be true if we were to double that over the next 5 years? So to move from 80 million patients being treated to 160 million with our products. And we came up with a current state, future state, and then defined our building blocks. And concepts such as Shark Tank for making choices, et cetera, is something that we can come back to maybe.
Yes, thanks very much, Chris. We'll come back to some of those topics of how you achieve growth at Johnson & Johnson. We're super interested to hear that. Helen, on to you.
Hi, so I'm Helen Edwards. I'm an adjunct professor of marketing. So I guess my point of view comes very much from a people perspective. And I guess when I'm working with companies and people talk about breakthrough growth, the question really quickly comes, well, where's it going to come from? And the default answer is often technology, and that's usually followed up by some reference to Clayton Christensen and disruptive technology. And that disruption where all the opportunities that are going to cascade from it, let's be disruptive. And it tends to be seen as a supply side phenomenon. The key point that I want to talk about today is coming the other way. And coming the other way can be just as exciting and just as disruptive. And that's disruption that comes from demand side. So that's where consumers, in their millions, change habits and adopt new ways of going about their lives. And that can propel new markets, new categories, new companies, and fuel growth. So if you think about it, a really recent example of this is the explosive growth of veganism. You know, it was a tiny minority who were vegans for decades. And then really since 2017, it's taken off. All of us, many of us, are vegan some of the time. It's worth $23 billion as a category in food and drink and growing. And that's before you get to the opportunities in health and beauty, in furniture, in clothing. In my book, I call this consumer-driven disruption. So that's when markets get overhauled by a force of collective consumer preference. And little waves that start with ripples just fundamentally change markets. And importantly, we can see these ripples now in today's marginal or fringe behaviours. And I think there are reasons why we're going to see more of them coming to the fore and fueling new growth for companies and markets. So it's an exciting, but it's a counterintuitive new route to growth.
Excellent. Fascinating. Thank you, Helen. Julian.
Yeah, so I'm a professor of strategy, and I research and consult the sort of the big picture changes in the competitive landscape. And I think of it as this, almost like this Darwinian struggle among, on the one hand, the big tech companies, the fast growing Amazons and Apples and Googles, you know those companies, they're in the news all the time. And then what you might call the stalwarts, the big companies, the Johnson & Johnsons of this world, who have kind of been around forever. And the simple point I want to just get across at the start is we spend all our time talking about these big tech companies and the way that they are rampaging over the landscape and killing everything else off in their wake. But we mustn't forget that, in fact, a lot of these old stalwarts are doing very, very well. I've been analysing, you know, which ones have survived. And, of course, the vast majority of them survive. The Nokias and the Kodaks are absolutely exceptions that prove the general rule. So my research tends, in fact, because it's less focused on, to try to figure out what it is that these big stalwart companies are doing to reinvent themselves and to stay agile and to stay relevant.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So I think all of you mentioned at some point disruptive technology, and we will get onto those stalwarts as you were describing there, Julian. But why don't we start off with disruptive technology? Because I think it's what most of us associate with breakthrough growth. We immediately think of technology unicorns, don't we? Mm-hmm. Now, tech unicorns have been getting a bit of a bad press of late, from culture to the whole way they're financed. And of course, they're facing a big challenge because the funding environment has changed. Linda, can I start with you on this topic, since it's something you know lots about? Do you think the era of sort of easy venture capital financing being challenged and maybe behind us a little bit will create a paradigm shift in how growth is financed?
I chair Bailey Gifford's the Shehalian Fund, which is a listed vehicle on the specialist fund segment of the LSE. We only invest in late-stage private companies that in other circumstances would be public, given where they are in their growth trajectory. But because of how much money in PE and VC there is, these companies are actually staying private longer. So an example of a company that we invest in is SpaceX. I always joke that when you do funding rounds, it's A, B, C, D. I always joke when we get to Z, do we just go back and do funding round double A for SpaceX if Elon Musk never wants to take it public because there is such interest in it. So actually in my book, I write about the tech crash. And in November 2021, the tech components of the NASDAQ dropped. I mean, we're talking 75, 80%. Now that's a crash in anyone's book. And whether or not that changes the paradigm, the landscape, I would probably, again, draw from my book and learn from history, which is the last time we had this kind of massive buildup in terms of euphoria around tech was during the dot-com bubble, where, you know, oh, there's so much to say about the dot-com bubble, but a small example is human nature is driven by euphoria. And there was this belief that e-commerce was going to take off, completely right, but maybe just 20 years ahead of time. So you had all these companies which were getting massive amounts of funding to create beautiful websites when we were still using dial-up modems. Do you remember dial-up modems?
Remember the noise.
Okay. And somebody would tell you, get off the phone, I need to get on the internet. And so what happened after the dot-com bubble was that the NASDAQ then collapsed. It didn't actually recover until the middle part of the 2010s. It took well over a decade. But then the boom started again. And by the time we got to November 2021, valuations were, before then, were so high that you started to really question whether or not the values of these companies, we weren't talking about unicorns, we were talking about tetracorns, you know, so everyone's a billion, you
know, dollars.
Yeah, that's nothing. That's really worrying. So it's not surprising that the valuations have come down. So the one trend I would say that has changed is it is now becoming more normal to have down rounds. So up until this point, because of the way the structure, the incentive of startups is, you have equity invested in the company, so you don't want to see the value of the company come down. So there's an unwillingness to accept a round. So Stripe is a company we invest in. They very publicly took funding at a round that valued the company much lower than what it was previously, because that's the return of the founders and all the employees. So to me, that's the one change that has happened. If you can begin to normalize down rounds, then you could find private companies are more cyclical. And I would say there's still a lot of firepower in the VC and PE community, but people are much more wary about valuations. I mean, profit is a whole other debate. I mean, but anyway, so I think the funding is absolutely key to help these companies achieve breakthrough growth. That I have no doubt, because probably one of the reasons why you see these massive companies in the US and China is because the ecosystem really funds their growth. And one of the challenges Europe has is we have some companies, but we don't actually have the same scale.
Yeah.
And I suspect it's because the banking system here dominates. It's about 80-20 to capital markets. In the US, it's the other way around. Capital markets are 80% of funding. Banking is around 20%. So I'm told that hopefully that gives you a flavor of when you learn from history, as Mark Twain is right, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So hopefully we'll learn something, right?
that's an excellent introduction. Thank you, Linda. Julian, to come on to you on this topic, I just wanted to ask one more question about unicorns. Linda mentioned there the word profit, and this surprised me over the last 10 years how the whole culture around financing companies has changed to the extent you'd meet young entrepreneurs and they'd never mention the idea of profit. And you see so many companies that don't even have a gross margin even. So all of the usual sort of business fundamentals kind of went out of the window. Now we're starting to see some sobriety coming back into those conversations. Do you think that we're going to see a return to more sort of normal business fundamentals when we finance growth?
Yeah, as soon as you hit a down market like the one we're in now for venture-backed firms, as you say, the business realities then kick in. The only way that you can sustain crazy valuations when you're making no money, of course, is through exponential growth. That growth has now been curtailed. And so we're seeing a very appropriate sorting of these business models. And there was something like, I was looking at the numbers, 1,300 unicorns last year. That number has now dropped to about 1,200. I think it should be half that. I mean, there really probably are only 400 or 500 companies worldwide who actually have the prospects of really being successful. So what that's happening is they are now being pushed to turn a profit. If you all remember the dot-com, just one last thought on that. You know, Amazon's biggest breakthrough was in the year 2000, they managed to make an operating profit for one quarter. And this was Jeff Bezos proving to the world that Amazon was not like all the other dot-coms, that they actually could make money. So he actually sort of starved it of investment just for a little bit, made a little bit of a profit, an operating profit, and then they could start reinvesting again. They didn't make any money for the next 5 or 10 years. So that is the game. You've got to show that you've got an operating profit model that works. And then the investment continues to flow.
Helen, did you want to come in here?
I suppose I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, is always people. You've always got to persuade people to pay for something. It's not difficult to get growth in consumption if you're giving it away. That's easy. It's then persuading them to pay for it. And I think probably we just don't focus enough, and startups don't focus enough on, what am I doing to serve people better? I think they start with their idea, rather than, what am I doing to serve people better, which they're eventually going to pay for, because that's the route to profit.
So we've spoken a little about startups, we've spoken about unicorns. What about large established companies, as Julian was talking about at the start? Chris, how does a company like Johnson & Johnson look for growth when it's a big established company? It's been around for a long time. Can you just give us a little bit of a flavour of how established companies look for growth in the current environment?
Absolutely. So I think there's really two parts to that. So firstly, innovation. Innovation is our oxygen, and in all tech firms. So there's, I think, over the 130 years of Johnson & Johnson, there's a long history of investing in new technology, acquiring companies, and there's probably many case studies of Johnson & Johnson integrating those businesses into this decentralized organization. Over the last 20 years that I've worked there, it's changed slightly and it's become more Johnson & Johnson as a whole, but still using our own venture fund, using innovation labs, funding startup businesses, supporting their growth to have a first choice option on potentially acquiring at a later date, or even just learning in partnership with them through that. So that's a massive focus for J&J. And then even just actually in the second part, within our own control, with the resources we have today, we have amazing solutions. And I spoke at the beginning about the significant unmet need. And for me, it's always a case of making choices about where we focus, where we double down. So analyzing and assessing the marketplace, where are patients waiting for us? Where is the biggest disease burden? How can we make a difference? And then as a result, with our same resource, making choices and driving growth and having impact in that way.
It's interesting that you spoke about, you know, where is the disease burden for patients, because that leads me on to some of Helen's research, because we often think of innovation as being sort of passed down to us by sort of brilliant entrepreneurs and tech companies. I mean, probably an example everyone is familiar with today would be ChatGPT. We all knew AI was around, but I was really surprised by the quality and speed of adoption of that. But lots of innovation isn't like that, is it? A lot of it actually is demand led by consumers. You've done lots of research on this, haven't you? Can you just talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, I think when you look at what people are doing, not even consumers yet, what people are doing with their lives and how they want to live their lives, you get early clues as to where the demand's going to come from. And that's what I've been looking at. So when you look at marginal or fringe behaviours, call them early adopters if you like, not all of them will be early adopters, that's important to say, that gives you a clue as to where future demand is going to come from. So even if you look at something like med devices, there's a whole group of people who are interested in being the quantified self, so that's measuring daily biometrics in order to get to better health. Now, if you take something like that where there is an answer from technology, people are interested in, and then you get COVID, that gives it a shove because everyone's suddenly aware of their own health much more. We're aware that health systems are under pressure, and you've got a kind of colliding of factors that mean a particular demand area will take off. And I think very often when you get this, it fuels multiple categories. So when I talked about veganism, you know, the growth of veganism isn't just in food, it's in clothes, it's in healthcare and beauty, and it's in furniture. So it fuels multiple categories instead of just one.
Linda, you want to come in here?
Helen is right. What's really interesting about the current generation of startups is they are actually very focused on consumers, on ESG, and on disintermediation. So they do something existing better. So the other notion around innovation is everyone thinks innovation is SpaceX because you can get broadband from satellites. Oh, I shouldn't say, of course it's innovative. We invest in SpaceX. That is absolutely part of it. And of course in the medical breakthrough, absolutely. But there's a lot of what's called micro inventions. So the macro inventions take you here. And then it's the adaptation of those inventions, the incremental improvements that actually drive economy-wide productivity changes. That's a lesson we learned from the late 1990s, which was the only period in which productivity growth in the U.S. rose. since then and before then, and in the UK and in all major economies, including countries like Japan, South Korea, Germany, productivity growth has actually been slowing since the 1980s. So this is the solo paradox, which is you can see the computer age everywhere except in the productivity data. So if everything is so innovative, why is it we have such low productivity growth? And the answer is actually around incremental micro inventions adoption. And companies that get that right are the ones that I have seen who work in areas which you wouldn't consider to be high tech. You know, I have seen eyewear, footwear, luggage companies, I mean, just traditional industries where you think, really? But the innovation is in the disintermediation, the cutting out, the middleman, the speed of delivery, the customization, the tailoring to customers, doing it more sustainably. That's all micro invention. So sure, the shoe is sustainable, it's vegan, but it's everything else that achieves that breakthrough. I've always found that to be absolutely fascinating. Just to finish on another point that Helen has made, it is always about the people. Do they have the right culture? Now, that's a whole other lecture. Probably need to get Julia to observe on that.
I mean, just one final point on the thing that Helen started. I mean, you didn't use this word, but sometimes we have these so-called platform innovations on which additional micro-innovations can be built. And, you know, the iPhone, the genius of the iPhone was not the touchscreen. It was that it was a phone on which applications could be built. And the App Store obviously exploded as soon as the iPhone and then the Android platform will launch. And I mention that because, of course, you know, we play with ChatGPT. That is a product of OpenAI. And you know, the clue is in the name. They have built OpenAI as a platform on which artificial intelligence will be accessible to everybody. So we are at the beginning of this fascinating period where over the next couple of years, we're just going to see hundreds, if not thousands, of artificial intelligence products built on that platform.
I wanted to bring Chris in a moment on culture, as Linda mentioned, but just very quickly staying with you, Julian, because I wanted to ask you about something that Linda also mentioned, which was productivity. This is something that I find very confusing because, as Linda said, we've got all these wonderful technology tools that have all made our lives, in some ways, much easier, certainly large parts of our working lives. I remember a colleague at work talking about this a couple of years ago and speculating that perhaps the Office of National Statistics was measuring this stuff wrong. Yeah. Why have we got such low productivity when all these wonderful tools have made our lives so much easier?
Well, there are many books and conferences devoted entirely to that subject. So some of it is about measurement. We just don't know quite how to measure it. Another, of course, is that some people claim wait and see. I mean, some people will literally say that technology investment has been made and that we will see the upturn coming through from it. I'm not completely sure that's right. I mean, when I was looking at the statistics recently, you know, UK, of course, as Linda says, you know, we're in a bit of a funk. I mean, our productivity growth is tiny. The only growth we get, interestingly, in terms of productivity, is basically by working longer hours. So it turns out if you compare the UK to France, but UK can only get any sort of growth by working longer hours. France actually has higher productivity than us. And what the economists call total factor productivity, an academic term, but basically the sort of the stuff you can't quite measure, which comes through innovation in better ways of working, that seems to have kind of got stuck and nothing. So my personal answer to the question is, what should we be doing differently? And it does start to lead to the people question is, we've just got to find ways of actually making more value, getting more value out of the human part of the equation. In other words, to work smarter, not just work longer. And that is, I'm not saying we've cracked it, but that for me is the root of the solution.
Linda, you wanted to just follow up quickly?
Just on the measurement issue, I was just going to use an example to illustrate why we think it's very hard to measure total factor productivity or economy-wide productivity, because we are predominantly a services economy, increasingly so, because software as a service, SaaS, is now a big grooming area. API, which is the stuff inside the stuff that connects all the stuff. There is a more technical term, but everything is intangible. We're in the intangible economy. How do you measure the output of that? So this is how the ONS does it. So can you raise your hand if you've been in a meeting that's been absolutely boring and a total waste of time? Okay. Those of you who haven't raised your hand, come up and tell me what you do for a living. But how many of you have been in a meeting which has achieved a breakthrough, just really got a project going, you know, really unblocked something, and this moved everything forward? raise your hand? Oh, please raise your hand. Okay, so in statistical terms, that hour of productivity, output per hour, is the same. Hmm. Because the measurement of services is input-driven, not output-driven. You can make quality adjustments, and there's all sorts of reasons you should, declining prices, Moore's law, computing power, blah, 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 blah. But we don't yet measure it properly. It's not the whole answer, but I like to think we're not nearly as unproductive as all the statistics say, especially vis-a-vis France. I mean, that would
just, you know. can I just add a thought, which is I think we're also seeing a generation of consumers and a generation of people who are working who want a different sort of productivity and a different sort of growth and different sort of life. And that might sound a bit idealistic, but certainly when I did my research, and we did research in the UK and the US, what we were seeing is as a drive for the way I want to live my life and what I want to consume, often a primary or a secondary driver for that was respect for the planet, respect for humanity, respect for my time and animals. And I think that will come more to the fore, that people will look for a different sort of growth, a different sort of way of working and even productivity, I think.
Yes, I want to follow up on that actually in a moment, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about sort of culture and leadership first, because it's no good just having the bright idea or the right idea even, is it? I mean, we were just talking before we started about a couple of classic examples of companies that came up with fantastic ideas. For example, famously Kodak invented digital cameras but couldn't capitalise on it. There's another interesting example of Xerox creating a kind of like Windows-style computer interface, and apparently Steve Jobs went and visited and saw it and couldn't believe they weren't exploiting it. Chris, can you tell us a little bit about how large companies can set about having the right culture so they don't make mistakes like that, and if they do come across the right idea, they're ready to exploit it?
A couple of things come to mind. Firstly, I think when you are working within a company where there is continuous integration of new businesses through acquisition, you've always got an opportunity to learn from organisations that, for the reasons why we acquired them, are doing something right and they're growing. And sometimes it reinforces and rekindles actually what was core within the main business in the first place. So that's something I think always chairs outward. Being customer focused it's obvious, it's a basic, but it can sometimes be forgotten in complex work environments, particularly matrix organizations. And I think anticipating future demands, needs, so one that comes from being very close to your customer, taking big bets. I think sometimes you've got to be prepared to not get everything right in order to learn just through the process. So that's something that we're very much vested in. And I think that's where part of the innovation arm of J&J, scouring the global enterprise to see what's happening and what's working out there and what can we take from it and integrate where possible and harness.
You mentioned Shark Tank in your introduction. What's that? How does that work? And Shark Tank is the American term for Dragon's Den, isn't it? Is there any correspondence there?
Similar. So this is quite a fun concept. So I spoke around choices that we make. We've been on an interesting journey as an EMEA medtech organization focused on full potential. So it's a case of making choices. Where do we focus? So it starts with defining current state, understanding where are the fast growth segments, where are most patients waiting for us, where are our resources deployed today, and then co-creating a very bold, ambitious future state. I think that's critical. And by having this audacious goal of doubling the number of patients you serve, come back to the building blocks. And it was part of the building blocks process of the choices that we utilized the Shark Tank concept. So clearly there is huge opportunity across the region for investment and to have an impact to patients. So we pitched these cases and these opportunities against each other. Right. In a vigorous, it was fun, but it was competitive case for actually what are we going to choose to do, but importantly, what are we going to not do? Mm. And then we relentlessly reallocate those resources. We have a governance structure around that which allows us to check milestones, and if they're achieved, then obviously the next round of funding and investments made to reach that patient target, and if it's not, we go back into the next round of opportunities. So it's I think a no stone unturned approach to reviewing your business and trying to move away from status quo.
I think that's such a nice idea, because in big companies, there's always someone in the leadership team going, be more entrepreneurial. And what they really mean is be faster and cheaper, I think. I don't think they really want their people to be more entrepreneurial, because they'd get shocked if they were. Yeah. But I think the notion of the Shark Tank, where you sort of hive off and get people to be more entrepreneurial literally by pitching their ideas is very powerful, actually, because just shouting at people to be more entrepreneurial just doesn't cut it.
I mean, I hate to sort of inject any sort of reality into this conversation, but I'm going to have a go. I mean, the evidence is that these Shark Tanks, incubators, new venture divisions, almost all of them fail. And that's a bit of a downer. And I'm not going to be quite as rude as it sounds. Don't worry. So the evidence, and I've been working in this area for 20 years, I mean, these units, they're sometimes called disparagingly innovation theatre. You know, we do all this fun and games, it looks beautiful, we bring lots of people in, and then the actual track record of the businesses created from these things is poor. Now, that's partly exactly what you'd expect, because most new ventures fail anyway, whether they fail within corporates or whether they fail in the startup environment. But the other reason they often fail is because you don't give them long enough. And what happens is that the senior executives overseeing this, they get a little bit impatient and they expect to see some profits immediately. And they expect the first idea that came out to be the one that's going to be the big success. Well, what are the first two or three are actually failures? And the one that was going to be the 10th in line is the one that's a success. So there is no simple answer. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. I think it does have absolutely ancillary benefits. But if you're going to do this, my number one advice is, give it 5 or 6 years for sure. Make sure you don't evaluate progress until you've got at least 10 or 20 examples of what you do. And that long-term view at least gives it a shot, which in fact is going to bring me back to say something very positive about Johnson & Johnson, because for about 50 years, they've had an invention division called JJDC, Johnson & Johnson Development Corporation, probably the most successful corporate venturing unit around. I mean, I can think of a couple of others, but it's actually one of the most successful ones. And that's because they actually took a long-term view on it.
It's quite interesting, all that stuff, Julian, because I've just noticed we kind of go through sort of paradigms on this as well, don't we? If you go back 10 years, you used to have a completely hived-off arm where they would... And to be fair, I think there were a couple of successes. I think Xbox actually came out of that kind of model. But as you say, there were also lots of failures. And then a few years ago, we had the sort of investing in startups as an incubator thing, and not much really seemed to come out of that. So we do see lots of cycles on this. Linda, you wanted to come in here, didn't you?
In terms of when you fund startups, so the statistics in the US says it's no better, success is no better than a flip of a coin. 50% of all startups will fail. And so if you now transplant that into the culture of an established company, I will say some of the established companies have been impressively innovative. Even in the turn of the last century, you had big dominant companies. So you had the US Steels, you had, you know, these mega companies, and you had tons and tons of startups at the same time. And what tends to happen is the startups are the ones that stimulate the competition, and the big firms either buy them, lose out to them, you know, and these days you see exactly the same pattern. You see the big dominant tech companies, some, you know, Meta buying Instagram is an example, buying WhatsApp, and exit these days is actually more often by acquisition than IPO in the statistics. And who are they being acquired by? It's actually the big companies. This raises issues around competition, around whether or not the ecosystem is actually creating oligopolies. But my point is, this is, again, history. This is exactly what happened at the turn of the last century, the century of when America became the big economic power, and they did create the system in which innovation in these various ways did actually work. I'll finish with an example of Jeff Bezos, the guy who worked for Amazon, who created Amazon Prime. So how many of you have Amazon Prime? Yeah. Okay, so a lot
of people. We don't admit to it, but we've got it.
So the guy who invented that was also the guy in charge of Amazon Fire. How many of you had that? Oh, sorry. And so he told me, you know, but Jeff Bezos has this view when he interviews people, which is, you know, if you haven't failed big, you haven't tried to move the dial. And I said, that is great. That really fosters innovation in a big company. So when he failed in Amazon Fire, even the demo didn't work when they launched it. He writes about it in his book. And I was talking to him about it. And I said, but that's fantastic. Bezos created this culture where, you know, you can actually fail in order to succeed. And then he joked, yeah, but imagine if Amazon Prime had failed. And so, you know, so just, you know, so that is the challenge of big companies and quarterly reporting and all of those things. And that's why Kodak failed to capitalize on digital photography, because they're reporting quarterly. It would have cannibalized their film sales. They were selling film. And it's that ability to be willing to, that's hard when you've got shareholders, boards, quarterly reporting. So maybe the suggestion is we ought to have longer term reporting, which is another John Kay recommendation, actually.
I want to get onto this. I'm really interested in this. You know, how do we measure growth? And actually, are we looking for the wrong things? But first, Chris, I just wanted to give you a quick opportunity to whether you wanted to come back on any of the challenges Julian had set on how we go about finding growth in big companies. Have you, what have you found that works? What are the do's and don'ts?
Well, we definitely haven't cracked it. So we're on a journey. We engaged McKinsey on this exercise. I think it's all about trying to create a culture as well where you are trying to push the boundaries. You're trying to move the needle, as we've said. And if you don't try, you can guarantee you're never gonna get there. So, trying to instill a culture where people can think big, unconstrained, think like owners, extreme ownership, end-to-end accountability. That's all concepts that we're bringing into our culture while focusing on talent, developing general managers for the future, etc. So, whether it does work or not, I'll come back to you maybe this time next year and share some successes or not. But yeah, I think if you don't try, then, well, you're guaranteed to be...
I mean, I guess, of course, I agree with what you said. And I actually think having these shark type activities is a good thing. I mean, I don't want to be misinterpreted. It is very, very good for the culture to have these opportunities. But, you know, the hard look at the data says that if you disconnect them too much and make them, you know, too sort of autonomous and too kind of, you know, an activity for its own sake, then the chances of it working are small. Because most of the good ideas actually can be found within, I mean, and they're often quite close to the core. And they also need top management, not just blessing, but literally top management stewardship. Because, you know, they used to talk about the incubator, as you say. Sometimes those incubators became orphanages. I mean, they were the places where, you know, ideas were left to sort of to be on their own. We need absolute top stewardship of the bottom-up ideas for these things.
But isn't the long term of that really hard? Because I think management teams change faster than ever now, and then someone comes in with a new idea and they want to be famous for something else, and then that gets junked and then another initiative comes forward. So I think all of that is really not conducive to these kind of long-term pictures.
Yeah, I mean, it is the case that the constant changing at the top, you know, the reason the corporate venturing incubator gets killed is because the new chief executive comes in and he or she kills off the thing before. So longer term thinking, longer term stewardship, you know, sometimes, not always, but sometimes these private companies and these family owned companies who really care about the longer term are actually the best stories of the long term growth of the long.
This whole discussion we've been having is kind of predicated on the idea that growth is good and our economies are set up. We measure GDP growth, we want companies to grow, and that's all based on consuming more and more of the planet's finite resources. We are starting to see some people question that, aren't we? Helen, what do you think, where do you think we're going with this? Are we going to have to scrap GDP and come up with some kind of new measure?
Well, I think that's for Linda to solve that problem, but what I can say is that when I did my research, and we did a lot of research among just regular mainstream consumers in the UK and the US, they were looking to consume in a way that was more sustainable, more respectful to people, more respectful to animals. Now, how that's done is for business to solve, and especially with the coming Generation Z, actually, especially the biggest generation we've got, single cohort of all time, they are very aware of how what they consume, the impact that it has. And I think we can't ignore it any longer. And I think people, they're not going to consume something that's worse because it's more sustainable, but they're looking for business to solve that problem. And I think consumers are looking to consume better, actually, rather than consume more.
We have this kind of movement now, I think it's called degrowth or something like that, where people are challenging this idea that we should be just going for GDP growth all the time in economies. Do you expect this to become a larger movement in economics, Linda?
Yes, in the sense that I think people call it different things. In my book, I call it the Great Reset. So I think people are not just interested in the quantity of growth, but the quality of growth. Mm. Is it greener? Is it fairer? Does it look after the most vulnerable in society? This is actually an old concept in economics. Economics didn't used to be it's a social science, didn't even used to be a social science, it used to be philosophy. So if you think about Jeremy Bentham and the idea of utilitarianism, it was always this notion that we should be maximizing utility. Utility is never just pecuniary. It is always about the non-pecuniary, consuming leisure, for instance, over work. And that's what the pandemic has accelerated. So I completely agree. I think looking forward, ESG, some people are critical of it. They think it's just the new incarnation of CSR. I'm not sure why it always has to be an acronym myself. Like, why can't we just have more sustainable businesses that actually provide a better quality of life for all of us? And technology has its upsides and its downsides. So it's not just solely about technology. It's about how we consume, what our politicians, the policies they set, especially around fairness. And, you know, and I think picking up on Helen's points about consumers, you know, consumers actually have a huge, you know, we can vote with our, I was about to say pocketbook, but it's all on the iPhone these days, isn't it? You know, which says a lot, by the way. You know, you can vote for politicians that, you know, provide for a fair, greener society. You can buy from companies that do things the right way. To me, all of that is one of the best things that come out of a lot of re-examination, you know, of the last few years.
So these acronyms, CSR, ESG, et cetera. Julian, how real is this? Do you see companies actually genuinely investing in this stuff and genuinely want to be environmentally more friendly? If you think of that, you mentioned iPhone there, Linda, Apple, you know, usually the world's biggest company by value, an environmental disaster probably. Is this all window dressing?
So there is, of course, some window dressing, some greenwashing going on. There are some companies who are genuinely caring about the planet. Helen probably has a better list of those than I have. And then there's a whole bunch in between who are trying to reconcile doing the right thing as well as making profits at the same time and using clever mechanisms, innovative techniques to create products that actually square that circle. And of course, they can't all do that. So it is, I mean, it is the most important, I would say, business challenge of the day because, you know, capitalism is the world in which we live. Growth is sort of, you know, intrinsic to capitalism in the mindset. And yet excessive growth is going to create all these negative externalities. It breeds additional inequality in society, all those ills that we've got to get to grips with. Companies can only do so much. I mean, I do actually think this is a point where governments have a very helpful role to play in helping to set the terms and, for example, increase the reporting requirements so that we are more explicit about those negative externalities we create, so that business is pushed towards doing the right thing.
Julian, how do we get corporates to be more courageous in investing in growth?
So, I mean, some of them are absolutely coming out with very bold statements. Chris can speak specifically to J&J in a second, but, you know, Paul Polman at Unilever became famous for absolutely committing Unilever to go down the sustainable development goal path. And he got rid of quarterly reporting and went to annual reporting to the markets. And Unilever actually did quite well as a result. And that's just one famous example. There are many others. I think that chief executives are under huge pressure from their investor communities to make these statements. But, and there, of course, there is a caveat, because some of you will know the French company Danone. Emmanuel Faber was the chief executive there. And he lost his job because after committing to all these huge pledges around sustainable growth, he missed, three earnings in a row, and he lost his job as a result, explicitly as a result of that. So it's a challenge. I mean, that's all I can say at the moment. You've got to absolutely commit to these ambitious goals, but you have to still find a way of getting enough of the profitability. You know, you've got to put the money back into ESG to ensure that those long-term things are not hurt by a short-term earnings miss.
Chris, did you just want to follow up on that quickly? I want to challenge the idea that J&J is not great.
We absolutely are. We're a publicly listed organisation. You can see the investor relations reports online and everyone can digest that. I think when you look at the size and scale of a company like Johnson & Johnson, in EMEA MedTech, we're a $5 billion business operating in all countries, serving 80 million patients a year. There are many, many factors that obviously contribute to your potential growth and the impact you can have. And I think when you're dealing with high inflation, rising costs, burdens on healthcare environment, as we know, staff shortages, etc. There's internally clearly a desire to touch more patients. Sometimes that is then undone in another vein, in another market, in a different platform. So balancing that across the board to deliver a breakthrough growth across the whole is challenging, but definitely we're doing it. There are significant growth engines within Johnson & Johnson, within MA MedTech. Maybe they don't make the same kind of, they don't get the same attention because everything's then obviously combined as part of one business performance. It's a great question. I think we need to be bolder as well. And if you do it with the right purpose, and we're there very clearly to treat patients, I think you can't question that ambition. So
I think part of it is probably a challenge to sort of my world a little bit as well, because in business reporting, we do tend to focus quite a lot on, as we said, the big tech companies, but also venture capital gets a huge amount of attention, but we probably don't do enough on the corporate venturing side and the kind of investments that companies like yours make. Mm. I just wanted to thank you all for a fascinating discussion. I've really enjoyed it. So thank you so much. And thank you to all of you for listening so patiently as well.
Thanks everyone for listening. I hope this discussion has inspired you. To find out more about our Think Ahead series and sign up for updates, go to london.edu/events. Until next time.